Mia. Now. Morning sunshine. I wake from a dream that breaks up immediately and leaves me with only the sense of someone shouting. Bryn is standing in front of me, hazy in the sun beaming in through the windows. I sit up, jittery from the dream I can't remember. What time is it? 10, Owen answers from the hall. A second later, he appears, showered and clean-looking, his hair curled wetly in a faded red t-shirt that says, London. The black eye seems to have grown overnight, bleeding down into his cheek. I don't know why people call it a black eye. This one is plum-colored.
Sorry, Bryn thought you'd want coffee.
When I bring a hand to my cheek, I can feel the spiderweb impressions of faint lines from the couch. Where's Abby? I ask. I don't remember falling asleep last night, only that Wade and Bryn were arguing about whether or not Haggard could have possibly known about Lovelorn, whether he could really have been the one helping Summer do the writing. And I decided to close my eyes just for a few minutes, and then I wasn't on a couch at all, but on a boat. At some point, I thought Owen was beside me. I thought he touched my hair and whispered, but that must have been part of the dream.
Wade must have dropped her at home on his way to work, Bryn says. They were gone when I got up. She probably didn't want to wake you up, Bryn adds quickly, because she must see that I'm hurt.
Bryn looks good, alert, dark hair bundled up in a messy ponytail, fashionably rumpled, as if sleeping on the floor in other people's houses with a sweatshirt for a pillow as part of her strategy for success. She passes me a styrofoam cup of coffee, too sugared, pale with cream.
Gotta caffeinate, she says. Today we nail Haggard.
Today? I nearly spit out my coffee. You want to talk to him today?
What's the point in waiting? She says.
I look to Owen. Old habit from back when I could count on him to agree with me, when I could read what he was thinking by the way he squinted his eyes, by the smallest twitch in his lips, when we didn't have to speak because we just understood. But he sighs, dragging a hand through his hair.
She's right, he says,
and only in his voice do I hear how tired he is.
I just want this to be over, finally.
And then what? I nearly say. Then Owen goes off to my dream school, and the Waldman house is sold, and I lose him forever. Bright, beautiful, matchstick Owen, full of crackle and life. Then Bryn does whatever Bryn is going to do, and Abby and I are still stuck here in Twin Lakes, and no one will hail us or call us heroes. And that's it. The end of the story. Curtains down, dancers gone home, a theater sticky with spilled soda and old trash. Then I will still be as lonely as ever. Lonelier, maybe. Because this time, there will be no chance that someday Owen will come home and we'll get to start over. In the bathroom mirror, I barely recognize myself. I look spidery and thin and old. My eyes are sinking into two hollows. I wonder what Summer would look like now, had she lived. All that blonde hair and skin like a new peach. I find a single half-used tube of toothpaste in an otherwise empty drawer and use my finger to clean my teeth, then finger comb my hair back into a bun. What will we say to Mr. Haggard?
Do you remember a girl named Summer Marks? Stupid. Of course he does. Everyone does. And he was at her memorial.
Mr. Haggard, we know what you did to Summer. Mr. Haggard, tell us what you know about Lovelorn. I whisper the words very quietly in the bathroom. There they sound silly and harmless, musical even. Number 44. Words mean different things to different people, at different times, in different places. Through the window, I see a dark car, the limousine type that service airports, nose through the gates and disappear from view. A second later, Bryn pounds on the bathroom door.
Mia, she whispers. What?
I say, opening the door. She looks as panicked as I've ever seen her. What is it? But then, from the front hall, a man calls.
Owen, you home?
The voice is instantly familiar, even after all these years. Mr. Waldman is back. Bryn edges behind me into the front hall, as if she expects Owen's dad to start shooting at her and wants to use me for cover. Mr. Waldman is almost unrecognizable. I remember him mostly as a disembodied voice, a voice slurring from behind a locked door to be quiet, go outside. He wasn't fat back then, exactly, but he was soft, blurry, chin folding into neck, into chest, into rolls of stomach. Even his eyes were blurry and seemed never to be able to focus on one thing without sliding over to something else. But Mr. Waldman now is all sharp corners and edges. Close-cropped hair, thin, a jaw like Owen's, perfectly defined. Even in his jeans, wearing a blazer over a t-shirt, he looks like the kind of person who's used to being listened to. Something old and damaged has, in the past 5 years, seemingly been fixed.
Dad.
Owen is frozen in the living room doorway, trying to block the mess from view.
Jesus!
Mr. Waldman takes in Owen's black eye.
What happened?
It's nothing, Owen says quickly. Just a stupid fight.
You look terrible,
Mr. Waldman says, and then looks at Bryn and me, squinting a confused smile in our direction.
Hello?
Bryn looks like someone trying to swallow a live eel. I try to say hello, but all that comes out is the final syllable. Oh.
You weren't supposed to be home until Friday,
Owen says.
Business closed early. I wanted to surprise you. Hopped a red-eye from L.A.
Mr. Waldman looks increasingly confused as he turns back to us.
And you are?
Owen shoves his hands in his pockets and kicks at nothing, making a scuffing noise on the floor.
Dad, Mia and Bryn. You remember Mia.
He won't look at me. It occurs to me that he's embarrassed. Blood beats a hard rhythm in my head. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Mia, of course, Mia. And Bryn.
But this time when Mr. Waldman tries to smile, he only winces.
Wow, how wonderful. I had no idea you were all still in touch.
He turns to Owen, leaving the question unspoken. Why?
It's been kind of like our reunion tour, Bryn blurts out, but we're just wrapping up.
Mr. Waldman's attention moves to the living room, the mess of papers, coffee-ringed styrofoam cups, empty chip bowls.
What happened here?
He says.
There another storm I didn't hear about?
I shove past Owen and start snatching up pages, one by one, some of them brittle, like old leaves, some of them damp as though imprinted by sweaty palms. I shuffle them carelessly into a pile, ignoring the echoes of an old fear. They'll be out of order now. We'll never be able to sort them. Summer will be so angry. Homework is the first thing I can think of to say, which is why I'm always so careful, why I weigh words in my mouth before I speak them. The first thing that comes out is often so wrong.
Homework?
Mr. Waldman sounds almost amused. Almost. But the strain is obvious in his expression.
In July?
Summer school. More lies, more words I haven't chosen, as though they're just staging a riot. For a second, I catch Owen watching me with the strangest look on his face, as if I'm someone he's never seen before. Owen agreed to help out because of NYU and everything. That doesn't even make sense, but Mr. Waldman nods.
Okay,
he says.
Okay.
Then,
Owen, can I see you for a second? Alone.
This is it. The end of the line. Get them out, Mr. Waldman will say. And Owen will be nice about it, give us an excuse, and shut the door in our faces. We dragged him into this. He didn't want any of it. All he did was kiss her in front of half the school and break my heart.
I was just about to drive Bryn and Mia home, Owen says, already going for the door.
Goodbye, thanks for coming, please don't crowd the exits.
Nice to see you girls, Mr. Waldman says, but it's not hard to figure out what he really means.
Nice to see you leaving. Owen's car is stifling hot. The AC does nothing but flood hot air at us. I roll down the window, worried I'm going to be sick. I'll lose my chance to talk to Owen unless I do it now. But I won't do it. Of course I won't. Not here at 10:45 a.m. in a sweat, sticky car. Not anywhere. Never.
I'm not going home, Bryn says as Owen reverses onto the lawn to turn around. I'm going with Mia.
She hasn't asked me, of course, but I'm too tired to argue.
Neither of you is going home,
Owen says. For a second, he looks just like the old Owen. Stubborn, explosive, unpredictable. The boy who lived half the time out of his treehouse and wore a bulky flea market trench coat everyone said he would someday conceal a gun inside and spend half of class gazing out the window, doodling shapes in his notebook. Brilliant and strange and mine.
Not yet, anyway. We owe Mr. Haggard a visit, remember?
Bryn. Then. Nice skirt, Mia, Summer said, bumping Mia on the shoulder with a hip before she slumped into the seat next to me, even though for more than a month she'd been avoiding us entirely, turning down different hallways when she spotted me from a distance, refusing to answer any of my texts. In the cafeteria, she'd practically shoved me when I put an arm on her shoulder. Stop drooling, McNally. I'm not into girls, okay? Furious, practically spitting, as if I were the one who ruined everything, who told about what had happened between us the night she climbed into my bed. It was April, a raw day when the rain couldn't decide whether to come down or not, and so just hovered in the air making trouble. Trying to give Mr. Haggard a view of your prime real estate? Shut up, Mia hissed. He'll hear you. So what if he does? Hey, Haggard! My friend Mia wants to know if you think she's pretty. I said, shut up, Mia said. We were stopped at a light. Haggard twisted around in his seat, bracing himself with one arm on the steering wheel.
What's the trouble back there, girls?
Mr. Haggard's voice sounded like it was rumbling out of a foghorn. Nothing, Summer called back sweetly. We were just saying how cute you look in your new jacket. I elbowed her. She rolled her eyes. Just giving him some excitement, she said. Look at him. He probably can't even see past his stomach to his dick. Can you not? Mia made a face. Mia hated every word associated with sex, but dick, pussy, and lube were among her least favorites. I knew because in the fall of seventh grade, back before Summer had turned on us, back when we were all best friends, she made a list during a sleepover and took turns reading them out loud to make Mia squeal. Speaking of special occasions, I was trying to keep things light, like I hadn't been dying to talk to her, like every time she'd glared at me and looked away hadn't gouged me full of holes. Any reason you're gracing us with your presence? Couldn't get another ride, Summer said, shrugging. Gouge, gouge. Besides, she said after a minute in a different voice, I wanted to talk about the spring dance. We're still going together, aren't we? The three of us and Owen. She reached for my hand and squeezed, and my heart squeezed too. Once again, I forgave her. Forgave her for telling everyone I was in love with her. Forgave her for taking my deepest secret, my truest thing, my love for her, and turning it into a joke. You still want to go with us? Mia's face was suspicious, but also hopeful, happy. We just didn't work without Summer. Uh-huh. She unwrapped a piece of gum carefully. Her nails were painted yellow and chipping. I might need your help with something soon, too. It's about love, Lauren, she added casually, almost as an afterthought. I thought we weren't playing anymore, I said. She looked up at me, eyes wide and sky blue, eyes to fall into. Who said it was a game?
The problem with the chasm of wish wasn't so much what it contained. Wishes weren't in themselves dangerous, and many Lovelorians had lost years, decades even, swimming in the river at its bottom, buoyed up by wishes, enfolded in the happy visions of everything they'd ever wanted. Which, of course, was the problem. Not getting in, but getting out. From The Way into Lovelorn by Georgia C. Wells.
Bryn, now. We pull Mr. Haggard's address easily from whitepages.com. He lives on Bones Road in Eastwich, a speck of a town 20 minutes away. While Owen drives, Mia tries Googling Mr. Haggard to find out more about him. There are only a handful of results. Mr. Haggard at a church picnic, Mr. Haggard manning a booth at the local Christmas bazaar, Mr. Haggard smiling with his arm around a skinny kid in front of a YMCA where he apparently coaches basketball. That proves it, I say. Church and Christmas and coaching, that's like the trifecta for pedophilia. Or he's a really nice guy who just likes kids, Mia says. Or he's pretending to be a nice guy who likes kids sweaty and worked up. That's gross, Bryn. I'm not the pedophile. Besides, this was your big idea. I know. Mia turns to face the window. It's just...
Just what?
Owen asks, so quietly I barely hear him over the rush of the AC. It feels different during the day. Harder to believe. She's right. In the middle of the night and amped up on coffee, Haggard seemed inevitable. The nice, dumpy bus driver, silently sporting a hard-on for summer, maybe earning her trust, offering to help her out with homework, turning on her one day when she wouldn't give him what he wanted. Now, with houses flashing by behind neat-trimmed hedges and packs of kids riding bikes in the road, wind turbines up on the hill waving slowly, it's hard to believe that anything bad could ever happen or has ever happened. It strikes me that maybe that's the reason for it all. The nicely mowed lawns and hedges and houses painted fresh every few years. We build and build to keep the knowledge down that someday it will fall apart. Bones Road is not what I expected. No old graveyards and headstones like splintered fingernails, no stormy-looking manor houses, no run-down farms with goats glaring at us from behind barbed wire. It looks kind of like my street, actually, with a bunch of pretty ranch houses set on identical tracts of land. Lots of American flags and mailboxes in the shapes of animals and lawns, littered with plastic kids' toys. Mr. Haggard's house is painted a cheerful yellow. There's a big SUV in the driveway. Owen parks down the street as if he's afraid Mr. Haggard might make a run for it if he so much as catches sight of the car. For a few seconds, we just sit there, after he cuts the engine, letting the heat creep back in. Doubts are still waggling their fingers at me. What's the game plan? I ask. We need a cover story. I mean, we can't just barge in and ask him if he killed Summer. Follow my lead, Owen says, like he's the hero in a bad cop movie and we're about to bust a terrorist ring. Outside, the sun is doing its best to turn the pavement to butter. In the distance, kids are laughing and splashing and the air smells like barbecue. I haven't had anything to eat since we fueled up on gas station chips last night and I'm starving. For a quick second, I wish I lived here, on Bones Road, in one of these tidy houses. I wish a mom and dad were busy grilling up lunch while I went splashing through a sprinkler. But like my mom always said, wishes are like lotto tickets, they never pay out. An old frayed welcome mat on the front stoop reads, "There's no place like home." Owen jabs the doorbell, and musical notes echo through the house. Standing there gives me the uncomfortable feeling of being a little kid on Halloween, waiting for someone to swing open the door. Trick or treat! I count 4, 5, 6 seconds. What if he's not home? Mia whispers.
Someone's home,
Owen says. The car's in the driveway. But, Mia starts to protest, but quickly falls silent. Footsteps patter toward us. He is home after all. But it's not Mr. Haggard who swings open the door. It's a little girl. A girl maybe 11 or 12, wearing a bathing suit and hot pink shorts, with a cloud of blonde hair and sky blue eyes just like Summer's. For a second, we all just stand there, gaping at her, three fish hooked through the lip. She rests one foot on the inside of her opposite knee, stork style.
Who are you?
She asks. Who are you? I finally manage to say, but before she can answer, more footsteps, a brown-haired woman, appears behind her and draws the little girl back. She's bouncing a blonde-haired boy on her hip. Her face is coated with what looks like strawberry jam.
What did I tell you about answering the door?
She says to the girl, and the girl spins away from her squealing and disappears down the hall. The woman rolls her eyes and pushes hair from her forehead with the back of her hand.
Can I help you?
It hits me. We must have gotten the house wrong. Owen must think so, too, because he says, We were looking for Mr. Haggard. Do you know where... But she cuts him off. You're not selling anything, are you? No Bible subscriptions or anything? Owen shakes his head. It's for a project. His voice sounds like it's being squeezed through a tube of toothpaste. She waves us inside. The boy on her hip is sucking on his fingers, staring. Come on, everyone's out back. Quickest way is through the kitchen. She's already heading down the hall and we have no choice but to follow her. The house is small and messy in the best way. Kids' toys and fuzzy blankets. TV showing a baseball game and a teenage boy who doesn't acknowledge us, watching it with his elbows crooked to his knees. Kitchen exploding with platters of food, potato salad, macaroni salad, hamburger meat, hot dog buns. I look at Mia and she shakes her head as confused as I am. A sliding glass door leads from the kitchen to the backyard. Kids are running around a wading pool, and the fence is decorated with balloons. There must be 40 people out there, adults and kids, and a grill sending thick smoke into the air. Whatever Mr. Haggard is, he isn't lonely. The woman pushes open the sliding door. Dad, she calls, visitors! She turns back to us with an apologetic look. Sorry, it's nuts today.
We can come back.
Owen's face has gone practically as red as his hair, and I know he must feel just as bad as I do. Mia is staring straight ahead with an expression on her face like she's just seen her pet bunny electrocuted.
No, no, it's no trouble. Here he is now, she says,
and it's too late. Mr. Haggard is squeezing in sideways through the door, one hand on his stomach looking like Santa frickin' Claus, and we're here to assassinate him. And sorry, kids, there goes Christmas.
Hello,
he says. His eyes are twinkling. Actually twinkling. Between the twinkle and the long beard, he really does look like Father Christmas.
What can I do you for?
The woman, his daughter, has slipped back into the yard. I see a picnic table stacked with birthday presents, a little girl wearing a princess tiara.
This obviously isn't a good time, Owen says quickly.
Mia lets out a whistling sound like a punctured balloon. Mr. Haggard waves a hand.
My youngest grandkid turned 6 today. Wanted to dress me up as a princess and been running me ragged all day. I'm glad for a little break.
He fumbles a pair of glasses out of his front pocket. Great, now he looks exactly like Santa. Then again, old Saint Nick has all those elves running around doing work for no pay, so he's got some dirty little secrets of his own.
Now, let me see. You all are too old for Girl Scout cookies. Not to mention, I don't think this one fits the bill. Especially not with that shiner. Ouch.
He jerks his head at Owen and grins.
So, let me think. You all raising money for the school debate team or something?
There's a long, horrible beat of silence. I picture the roof collapsing, the kitchen exploding, an earthquake tossing us all into the air.
Actually,
Owen's voice cracks and he clears his throat.
We're volunteers from the Vermont Transportation Authority?
Mr. Haggard plugs a finger in his ear and rubs.
The what now?
But Owen just keeps talking, raising his voice a little as if he can drown out any of Haggard's objections.
To administer a quick survey about the public school bus systems as compared to private systems? Oh, boy.
He heaves himself onto one of the kitchen stools, still smiling.
Sounds heavy.
Owen finally runs out of breath and stands there half gasping.
Just a few questions,
he adds, about your experience and your bus route and what the kids are like.
Were, Haggard says. I retired last year.
Okay, Owen says. What the kids were like.
Haggard turns a smile on me. I feel like an ant underneath a magnifying glass.
Well, why don't you just ask these girls? Bet you remember the old bus route just fine.
You remember us? I stutter. His smile finally goes dim.
Course I do. You were my three musketeers. You two, and the other girl, Summer. Terrible what happened to her.
It's clear from the way he says it that he doesn't think we had anything to do with it. I try to beam to Owen and Mia that we should get the hell out of here and leave Haggard and his grandkids in peace. Apparently Mia doesn't get the message because she blurts out, Mr. Haggard, we're sorry. We haven't been honest. We're not here for a survey. We're here about Summer. We're trying to find out what really happened to her.
Forget the earthquake. Here's to hoping a renegade tiara whizzes in through the doors to decapitate all three of us. I see.
Haggard scratches his head through the thinning slick of his hair.
Well, I'm not sure whether I can be much help.
You remember her, though. If I'm going to hell anyway, I might as well make sure I've good and earned it.
Sure. I remember all my kids. Drove a bus for 40 years and knew that route like the back of my hand.
Did you grow up in Vermont? Owen asks, and I know he must be thinking of St. Louis.
Born and bred, Haggard says. He gives his stomach a thwack. They make us bigger out here, huh?
But his smile fades again.
She was trouble, that one, tell you that. Had a mean streak.
Then, as though he remembers who he's talking to, he stands up.
But you probably knew that, huh? I felt sorry for her.
Mia shoots Owen a look I don't have time to puzzle out. How come? I say.
She seemed lonely,
he says.
Even when she was with her friends, with you two, she seemed lonely. Lost, you know.
Lonely. Lost. The words remind me of the passages we pulled about the shadow. Was Summer the shadow all along? I never thought of Summer as lonely, not once. But then I remember the night she climbed in through my window, the way her ribs looked, standing out in the moonlight, her tears running into my mouth even as we kissed. Nobody loves me, she said, over and over again, her chest spasmed against my palms like she was dying. Nobody. Nobody, nobody. Were we wrong about everything? Maybe there was no mysterious shadow in real life. No one who got close to her and started feeding her stories. Maybe she did write the pages herself. Maybe some psycho met her in the woods and just seized his chance. A little boy comes tumbling into the kitchen, knees grass-stained and face all scrunched up in red, wailing. He holds out his arms.
Grandpa!
He says,
Grandpa! Grandpa!
What's the matter, Greg?
Haggard places a wrinkled hand on the kid's head. I give it a last shot and try to picture that hand wrapped around a knife, bringing a blade down into Summer's chest and neck over and over, but my brain just burps and goes quiet. The woman who let us into the house is a second behind Greg, drawing him away. Oh, you're fine, Greg. Honestly, it was just a little tumble. And you know Grandpa can't pick you up. But she picks him up and plants a kiss on his forehead before rolling her eyes at us and hauling him back outside.
Slipped disc, Haggard says to us, placing a hand on his back and making an oh boy, that's age face. Used to volunteer with the EMT. Had a bad fall when my own kids were barely out of diapers. Can't barely lift a shovel in winter time.
He shakes his head. That's that. Whoever killed Summer also had to drag her. Mr. Haggard can't even pick up a toddler.
We're sorry for barging in on you like this, Mr. Haggard.
Owen's still glowing red as a hot pepper. He's put two and two together, too.
We're sorry for wasting your time. It's no trouble.
For a second, he looks like he's about to say more. Then I find a name for his expression. Pity. He feels sorry for us.
I hope you all find what you're looking for.
But as we make our way back into the heat, leaving the noise of shouting kids and laughter behind, just another summer Wednesday. Trees bursting like the joy is coming out through their branches. I know that we won't.
First had one special skill besides thievery, and that was this. People listened to him. He rode from town to town, from vale to glen, from hermit hovel to the princess's towers, and everywhere he stopped and delivered the same message. We've had it wrong, my friends. We've said someone must die so that others might live, but everyone must die. It is the natural way, the only way. Age comes and takes us. Sickness knocks on our door. Death is blind and picks at random. Everyone must die. Only then can everyone live, too. Only then can we banish the shadow from these lands. From The Way into Lovelorn by Georgia C. Wells.
Mia. Now. We don't speak on the drive back to Twin Lakes. Owen's knuckles stand out on the steering wheel, as if he's afraid it might spin out from his grip. Bryn sits, head back, staring at nothing. Once, when I was 5 or 6, my mom drove an hour and a half to Burlington to take me to a local production of The Nutcracker. I was wearing my best dress, green velvet with a crinoline skirt and lace at the collar, thick wool stockings, shiny leather boots that laced to my ankle. On the way there, it started to snow, light flakes that winked on the way down and melted side by side against the window. When we arrived, there were no women in long silk dresses, no ushers in flat caps passing out brochures, no crush of perfume and conversation. Just some teens out of uniform, sweeping up crumbs from the aisles and the stage naked and bare under the lights. My mom had gotten the start time wrong. The show was a matinee. The worst part of the whole thing wasn't even the disappointment, but how angry I was at my mom. We went across the street to a little diner, and she bought me a tuna melt and a chocolate sundae, and I refused to eat them. Driving home while the headlights sucked snow into the grill, I imagined setting out into the woods all alone until the silence took me. That's just how I feel now. We came too late. It's been too long. Summer should have spoken to us sooner. She should have let us. I'm furious at her all over again. Owen has to wheel up on the lawn to avoid hitting the dumpster in my driveway. Even before he's fully stopped, Bryn rockets out of the car without saying thank you. Construction? Owen asks. What? Suddenly, Owen and I are alone. Except I can no longer remember why I thought, even for a second, that we might repair something, stitch it back together. Owen, too, was probably fiction.
The dumpster. You guys doing construction?
He leans forward, squinting up at the house. Yes, I lie quickly. I let myself imagine it's true, that we're building instead of taking things apart.
I'm sorry, Mia, Owen says. I know you thought. I mean, I know it was important to you.
We were wrong about Mr. Haggard, okay? I say before he can finish. That doesn't mean we were wrong about everything. I seize onto this idea, haul myself forward, word by word. Someone was helping Summer write Lovelorn. Someone left clues behind. Maybe he was hoping to get caught. Owen rubs his eyes. For a second, he looks much older.
Mia.
Nothing else makes sense. I keep going because I can't stand to hear him contradict me. In my chest, a bubble swells and swells, threatening to burst. Whoever killed her knew all about the sacrifice. He knew about the woods and the shed and all of it.
Mia.
But I can't let him finish. We can talk to Mr. Ball again, or we look at Heath Moore. We know his alibi's bullshit now. I'm babbling, desperate. You heard Bryn. She took his phone. I bet there's a ton of creepy stuff on it. There's something wrong with him, and Summer was with him, right? Before she... Well, before you, I still can't say it. She might have told him about Lovelorn. She probably did. She could never keep her mouth shut.
No, Mia, no.
Owen twists around in his seat to face me, and the swollen thing in my chest explodes, flooding me with cold.
The clues don't lead anywhere. It's all make-believe. Don't you get it? It's still make-believe.
He looks like someone I barely know. New hard planes of his face. New mouth stretched thinly in a line. Not my Owen. The brilliant, wild boy. A boy meant to leap and spin alone in a spotlight. Not a scrap of him left.
I'm sorry.
Hot pinpricks behind my eyes mean I'm going to cry. I look down at my lap, at my hands squeezed into fists. You're sorry, I repeat, and Owen flinches, as if he thought the conversation was over and he's surprised to find me still sitting there. You're sorry. I press down the tears under the weight of an anger that comes tingling through my whole body, waking me up. You left. You got out. You're going to NYU next year, for God's sake. NYU. That was my school.
Seriously? Owen frowns. We always talked about going to NYU.
I always talked about it. I did. My voice sounds foreign to me, cold and hard and ringing. And you come back here with your cute little car and your fake British accent.
Hey.
Owen looks hurt, and when he looks hurt, he looks momentarily like the old him. But it's too late. I can't stop now. We've been buried here, don't you understand? We're suffocating. And you think you can make it better by saying you're sorry? You don't care about helping. You don't care. I break off before I can say about me. The tears are back now, elbowing me hard in the throat, making a break for it. I take a deep breath. How dare you show up after all this time and pretend? You're the one playing make-believe. You told me you loved me, but you don't. You couldn't. I didn't mean to say it, but there it is. Words are like a virus. There's no telling what kind of damage they'll do once they're out. Owen stares at me, and I'm so busy trying not to cry it takes me a minute to realize he's looking at me with pity.
I did, Mia, he says quietly.
Did. Past tense. As in, no longer. I make it out of the car without crying, without saying goodbye either, even though that's what I mean. Mia.
Then.
I was walking with Owen in the fall of sixth grade, arguing about whether or not AI would eventually spell the destruction of the human race. Him, yes, thankfully. Me, no, never. And dodging caterpillars plopping out of the trees onto the road like gigantic furry acorns. There were hundreds and hundreds of caterpillars that year, something about the reduction of the native population of bats. When all of a sudden, Owen broke off mid-sentence.
Uh-oh, he said.
I didn't even have time to say what. By the time I looked at him, he was standing calmly, head tilted back, cupping a hand to his nose while blood flowed through his fingers. So bright red it looked like paint.
It's okay, he said thickly, while I squealed. It happens all the time.
But I was already shaking off my sweatshirt, not caring that it was my favorite, not caring that my mother would kill me, not thinking of anything but Owen and all that blood, his insides flowing out in front of me, and pressing it balled up to his face, saying, it's okay, even though I was the one who was afraid, standing there until my sweatshirt was damp with butterfly patterns of blood.
Audrey, Ava, and Ashley stood, shivering in the sudden wind, and watched Gregoria disappearing with the shadow into the woods. At a certain point, it looked as if the shadow bent to whisper something to her. Then they were simply gone. From The Way Into Lovelorn, by Georgia C. Wells.
Mia. Now. You okay? Bryn asks. I'm going to have to dig up my old list of all the ways that words can turn to lies. Make some amendments to it. I don't bother answering. Inside, the smell of mold and wet and rotting cardboard is worse than ever. Or maybe it's just that everything's worse. I grab an armful of stuff from the side table, including a framed picture of me dressed as Odette in my dance school production of Swan Lake, grinning at the camera, dressed in tulle and point shoes and a frosty tiara, and turn right back around, stalk across the driveway, and heave it all up into the dumpster. Goodbye. Another armful. Mail and a carved figurine of a rooster, and a dozen loose keys in a basket, and an orchid in its clay pot, miraculously blooming despite the chaos. And outside, I throw it in a long arc, like a longshoreman tossing catches of fish. Not until I grab the side table itself does Bryn say something.
Are you sure? She starts, but trails off when I give her a look.
Bryn and I should never have stopped being friends. We must be the two most screwed-up people in Twin Lakes, maybe in all of Vermont. When the side table goes into the dumpster, it splinters. Two crooked legs stick up over the lip, like an iron cockroach trying to claw its way to safety. The dumpster's nearly full already, and suddenly it hits me how hopeless it all is. The house is still swollen with trash, like a dead body bloated with gases. Even from outside, I can see the piles shouldering up against the downstairs windows, the curtains going black with slime. I haven't made a dent. The tears come, all at once, like a stampede, and I stand there crying in front of this stupid dumpster with my house coming down behind me. I don't know how long I've been standing there when I notice a cop car, swimming slowly, shark-like, down the street. It stops just next to the driveway. I turn away, swiping at my eyes and cheeks. But when the cop climbs out, long-legged and narrow-faced, like a praying mantis, he heads straight for me. "Hello?" he says, all toothy smile, pretending not to notice I've just been sobbing alone on my front lawn.
"You must be Mia Ferguson."
"Can I help you?" I say, crossing my arms. He looks familiar, but I can't figure out why.
"I'm looking for Bryn McNally," he says. "Seen her recently?"
"What's she done now?" I almost ask. Luckily, my throat chooses the right time to close up. But a second later, Bryn bursts out of the door. Like she does. Like even air is a major barrier. Maybe just because she's sick of being inside with the smell. And the cop says, "Ah," like he's just solved a math problem. Bryn freezes.
"What is this?" she says. "Who are you?" "Afternoon,"
he says. I imagine the swish, swish of curtains opening across the street, neighbors peering out, wondering what we've done now, whether we're finally going to get it.
"Was hoping we could have a little chat. Name's Officer Moore."
He pauses, like the name should mean something. And then it does. Moore, as in Heath Moore. Bryn must make the connection at the same time. She looks furious.
"You're Heath's older brother," she says.
"Cousin," he corrects. His cheeks are round like a baby's and swallow his eyes when he smiles.
"Sorry to bother you ladies,"
he says, hitching his belt higher like we're in a cowboy movie.
"I'm here about a missing phone."
In sixth grade history, we studied the fall of Rome. We charted all the factors that led to the collapse of one of the most powerful empires of all time. Corruption, religious tension, gluttony, bad leadership. Little arms pinwheeling out from the central fact. Over 100 years, from superpower to sad little collection of city-states. But no one ever tells you that sometimes disasters can't be predicted. They don't throw shadows of warning over you. They don't roll like snowballs. They come like avalanches all at once to bury you. Look at Pompeii, a city singed to ash in a single day, or the way a first frost slices the heads off everything but the sturdiest flowers. Look at the human heart. Think about the difference between alive and not. One second, that little fist is going and going, squeezing out more time. And then it just quits. One beat to the next, second to second. One, sound and noise and motion. Two, another thump. Three, nothing. 15 minutes later, Bryn is sitting in the front seat of the cop car looking like a prisoner. Heath Moore, apparently too afraid to confront one of the monsters of Brickhouse Lane himself, sent his cousin to do the dirty work. Officer Moore went directly to Bryn's house, where he informed Bryn's very confused mother that her daughter had stolen a phone during an altercation at Summer Marks's memorial. Bryn's mother insisted she was at Four Corners. Four Corners insisted that Bryn had been signed out several days ago by an Audrey Augello. Officer Moore, no doubt thrilled that his missing phone case had turned into a missing girl case, and sensing the opportunity to do something other than throw teenage boys in the drunk tank for the night, tracked Bryn down to my house after learning we'd been seen together. And now Bryn is going home. I'm still standing on the front lawn. The sun is high above us, like a ball lobbed up in the blue. And I feel just like I used to during curtain call, with all the stage lights bright and blinding, and the applause already waning, an urge to laugh or scream or keep dancing, anything to keep the silence from coming. When Officer Moore starts his engine, Bryn finally looks at me. For a second, her face is blank, closed up like a fist. Then she brings a hand up, and I think she's going to try and say something. Instead, she presses her palm flat on the glass. I bring my hand up, too, just hold it there, even as the squad car pulls away and Bryn drops her hand, leaving a ghost imprint on the glass, even after they're gone and the noise of the engine has faded. Across the street, the curtains twitch. Someone is definitely watching. Just because, I take a bow. Show's over, I say out loud, even though no one's around to hear me. Inside, I stand in the dimness of the front hall, squinting at the piles, trying to imagine them as something beautiful and natural, stone formations or ancient gods. But it doesn't work this time. I see only trash, rot, mold webbing through the whole house. Maybe I'll never even go to college. Maybe I'll stay here forever, slowly yellowing like one of the old newspapers my mom refuses to throw away, or turning gray as the walls are now. Owen's voice is still echoing in my head. I did. Strangely, the urge to cry has vanished. The urge to clean, too. It's too late anyway. There's no point. There was never any point. Sorry, Summer, I say into the empty hall. Something rustles in another room. A mouse, probably. I close my eyes and imagine I can hear the amplified chewing of termites in the wood. I must have been crazy to think that Owen would ever want me now. Grown-up Owen with his cute little accent and his Boy Scout look, off to NYU and girls with pixie-cut hair and J. Crew smiles, girls with vacation homes in Cape Cod and the Hamptons, girls who aren't all jumbled up and split apart. Maybe my mom hasn't been collecting all this time, but reflecting, mirroring our chaos, the chaos inside. There's a sudden pounding on the front door. Bryn, maybe she left something. Maybe she catapulted out of the cop car and came running back. For a second, I even hope she did. Instead, my dad is on the front porch, waxy-faced, sweating.
Mia, he says my name as if it's an explosion. Mia, oh my God.
Dad? Then I remember that the door is open, just a crack, not enough for him to enter, not enough for him to see. And I try to slip outside, but he has his hand on the door and he stops me.
Where have you been?
He looks like he hasn't slept. His hair is sticking straight up, as if a giant has grabbed him by the roots and tried to lift him off his feet.
I was this close to calling the police. Tried you at least 20 times. Phone went straight to voicemail.
My phone was dead, that's all, I say. But he just keeps talking, leapfrogging over half his words so I can hardly piece together what he's saying.
Came by last night. House was dark, been calling for 2 days. Phone off.
I'm sorry, Dad. I wasn't feeling good, but I'm fine now, I quickly add. I'm worried he's about to have a heart attack. A vein is standing out in his forehead, throbbing as if it, too, is very upset. Finally, my dad runs out of anger, or out of air, and stands there panting, the vein still beating a little rhythm in his forehead.
Well, Jesus, Mia, open the door. I've been terrified. Your mother and I both...
You called Mom? All this time I've been talking to my dad through a narrow gap in the door and angling my body so he can't see inside. Now I slip onto the porch, closing the door firmly behind me. No way am I letting Dad inside. Dad's never been inside, not since he left.
Of course I called your mother. She's on her way home from Jess's house now.
Dad frowns and looks a little more like my dad, the stern podiatrist. I'm pretty sure that even as a kid he liked to dress up in suits and diagnose people with acute tendonitis. His eyes go from me to the door and back again.
Come on, he says in a normal tone. Let's go inside. I could use a glass of water.
No, I cry as he reaches for the door handle. Instinctively, I flatten myself against the door, keeping it shut. My dad's fingers are wrapped around the door handle.
Mia,
he says in a low voice. Someone who didn't know him might think he was being casual.
What are you hiding?
I'm not hiding anything. But suddenly the tears are back. Traitors, they always come at the worst moment. Please, I say, please.
I am going to open this door, Mia.
Now my father's voice is barely more than a whisper.
I am going to open it in 3 seconds. Do you understand me? 1, 2.
I step away, hugging myself, choking on a sob that rolls up from my stomach.
3.
For a long second, he doesn't even go inside. He stands there, frozen, as if he's fighting the urge to run. Then he lifts a hand to his mouth. Slowly, slowly, afraid to move, afraid to touch anything.
Oh my God,
he says. I'm sorry. I bend over and put my hands on my knees, sobbing in gasps. I don't know what I'm sorry for exactly. My mom because I didn't protect her. My dad because I couldn't stop it. I'm sorry, I say again. He barely seems to hear me.
Oh my God.
A few feet inside and his foot squelches on something sticky. He flinches. Another step. Crackle, crackle. Old magazines snap underfoot. Even from outside, I can make out the piles, pointing like fingers toward a heaven that doesn't exist. And all I can think is how mad he's going to be, and how mad Mom's going to be, and how I've messed up everything, even things that were messed up from the beginning. And I can barely breathe, I'm crying so hard. A broken girl with a broken heart living in a broken house.
Mia.
Then my dad turns around to face me, and I'm shocked to see not anger, but a look as if someone just tore his heart out through his chest. I've never seen my dad cry, not once, not even at his own mother's funeral.
But now he's crying, fully, without even bothering to wipe his face. Then he's rocketing out onto the porch again, and has picked me up like I'm still a little kid, so my feet lift off the ground and his arms are crushing my ribs, and I'm so startled that I completely forget to be sad. "It's okay, Dad," I say, even as he cries in big, long gulps. We've switched roles. Now he's the one apologizing.
"I'm sorry, baby," he keeps saying over and over. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry."
There was no denying it, no understanding it either. The fact was this: the shadow was getting stronger again. From Return to Lovelorn by Summer Marks, Bryn McNally, and Mia Ferguson.
Bryn, now. Wednesday morning, July 20th, 2 weeks after Heath Moore's cousin dragged me home, attempt number 1024 to reach Abby, fifth ring, sixth ring, voicemail.
Hey, this is Abby. If you're getting this message, it probably means I'm screening your calls.
I thumb out of the call just as my sister practically kicks in the door, still dressed in her scrubs, hair swept back into a ponytail and eyes raccooned with tiredness. She fists the door closed.
"Fucking thing's swollen," she says,
which is my sister speak for, "Hi, how are you? Nice to see you." But she comes and thumps down next to me on the couch, kicking up her feet on the coffee table, nudging aside Mom's laptop. A school brochure slithers to the carpet, wedged with post-it notes. "Ever since I got home, Mom's been writing away to every single alternative high school program on the East Coast. Not even an addict," she just kept saying when I told her, shaking her head as if she almost wished I was. "Really, Bryn? Well, I guess it's about time you finish up school then." Erin fishes a Coke from her bag, pops open the tab, and takes a long swig. "How was work?" I ask. She's been working doubles all summer, sometimes as many as 48 hours on shift, and then 2 days off when she crawls into bed. "Same as usual, lots of old people." Erin always talks this way, like she doesn't give a shit, but I know that's a lie. She's busted ass to get through medical school, taken out tens of thousands of dollars in loans, and she still takes money out of her paycheck to buy gifts for her favorite patients. "Saw your friend Mia again," she says through another slurp of soda. "She's not my friend," I say quickly, and I'm surprised that it hurts. Stupid. We spend 4 days playing Scooby-Doo, and now I feel lonely because the game's over. I've spoken to Mia only once since Moore brought me home. Went up to town for coffee, and I ran into her at Toast. She was dressed like she always dresses, in neat little shorts that look like they've been pressed, and her hair in a bun and a polo shirt. But she looked more relaxed, somehow. Less like she was moving with a yardstick up her you-know-what. She told me she was spending more time at her dad's while her mom got help from counselors at North Presbyterian Hospital, where my sister is doing her residency. Apparently, a whole team of people are treating her house for black mold spores and other nasty shit her father was afraid would ruin her lungs. "Have you spoken to Owen?" I asked her, and her face got closed again and she shook her head. And then, because I couldn't help it, I asked, "How's Abby?" Mia made a face. "Hanging out with Wade a lot. Can you believe it?" "Star Wars fandom," I said. "What can you do?" That made her laugh, but it was a forced laugh, like wincing. I never thought there'd be a day when I'd actually miss Wade. Half the time I text Wade now, he's with Abby. I nearly spilled everything to Mia then, standing in front of Toast with my iced coffee sweating through my fingers, about Abby and how mean I was, how stupid I was, how I actually kind of like her, how over and over I've replayed the kiss in my head. But then a woman walked by, tugging her child across the street and shooting us a dirty look, like we were contagious, and I remembered who we were, that it didn't matter, that the only thing that bonds us now is Summer's ghost. And Mia's dad pulled up in his sparkly Land Rover and tooted the horn, and she lifted a hand and was gone. I check my phone out of habit, thinking maybe by some miracle I'll find a missed call from Abby. In the past 2 weeks, I've tried locking my phone in a drawer for hours, shoving my mom's ancient TV as big as a mini-fridge in front of it to keep me from checking. I've thought about driving to her house. I even wrote her a letter, an actual letter on paper, before tearing it into pieces and flushing it down the toilet. You know, I've been talking with Mom about moving. Erin says this like she says everything else, like the words just rolled out of her mouth without her paying attention. I stare at her. Out of Twin Lakes? I say. We're thinking Middlebury. She shrugs. I could help Mom out with the moving costs. We're looking to get her a car, too, so she'd be able to commute to work. Things might be better. She doesn't finish her sentence, but I know what she's about to say. Things might be better for you. All I've ever wanted was to get out of Twin Lakes. But now the idea makes me feel like someone's placed my insides on blend. When? I ask, and she shrugs again. Soon as we figure out your school, she says. Soon as we figure out the money stuff. She reaches over and musses my hair like I'm still a kid. You could start over, Bryn. We could all start over. Yeah, I say. Okay. Her smiles are always so quick they look like they're being chased away. She yawns big, covering her mouth with the back of her hand. I'm going to bed. She stands up, handing me her Coke. Want the rest of this? Sure, I say and take it even though it's warm. A second later and I'm alone, listening to the chugging of the window AC, the sun through the windows still making my neck sweat. We could all start over. A nice idea. Except that it's never that easy, is it? I remember how summer looked the day we found those sad little crows, one of them still struggling in the snow, its feathers stiff and clotted with blood. It's lovelorn, she said. It doesn't want to let us go. And how we found her that day in the woods, holding on to that poor cat. The way she turned to us, as if she hardly recognized us. Here's the problem with starting over. Summer won't let us. She doesn't want to let us go either.
Summer, Mia, and Bryn no longer had a choice. If they didn't give the shadow something to feast on, its hunger would only grow. That day they set out for Lovelorn in silence, and each of them carried a special item. Mia had a pocketful of pebbles she'd scooped out from her driveway to use for marking the circle. Bryn had a matchbook, and Summer carried the knife. From Return to Lovelorn by Summer Marks, Bryn McNally, and Mia Ferguson.
Bryn. Then. June 29th was a perfect day. It wasn't raining, there were no storm clouds, the trees weren't whispering to one another but stood high and quiet with their arms to a blue sky. The bees clustered fat and drowsy in the fields, and birds pecked at their reflections in the creek. It wasn't a day for nightmares or scary stories or shadows. It wasn't a day for Summer to die. Meet me in Lovelorn, she texted that morning. It's time. At first, we thought the whole thing was a joke. That's what I told myself over and over, what I tried to tell the cops. A joke, or just part of Summer's storytelling, her way of making things real. We didn't really think there would be a sacrifice. We didn't really think she was in danger. Then why did you go at all? The cops asked. Because she needed us, because we missed her, because it was Lovelorn. You just said you didn't think Lovelorn was real. We knew it was a story, but the story was also coming true. So did you believe or didn't you believe? That was the question I could never truly answer. The truth was both, and the truth was neither. Like that old idea of a cat in a box with a lid on it, alive and dead at the same time until you look. We believed in Lovelorn, and we knew it was just a story. We knew there was no shadow, and we knew that Summer needed us. We loved her, and we hated her, and she understood us, and she scared us. Alive and dead, I've thought about that a lot. When we saw Summer standing in the long field, shading her eyes with a hand to look at us, clutching something, a rug or a stuffed animal with her other, that she was both, that somehow what was about to happen to her was already built into that moment, buried in it, like a clock counting down to an explosion. That's what I thought the cat was at first. A rug. A stuffed animal. Not real. None of it could be real.
You came, was all Summer said. In the week since school had ended, we hadn't seen her. I hadn't spoken to her at all since the last day of school, when, passing me in the hall, she'd suddenly doubled back and seized my hand. I'm going to need you soon, she'd whispered, pressing herself so close to me that a group of eighth-grade boys had pointed and started to laugh. By then, the rumors had been everywhere for months. That I hid in the toilet stalls and spied on the other girls changing, that I'd invited Summer to sleep over and then slipped into her bed when she was sleeping. Summer looked small that day in the field, in a white dress and cowboy boots, both too big for her. Scared, too. There was a stain at the hem of her dress. Cat puke, I later realized. I didn't know if you would, she said, and as we got closer, I saw that her face looked bruised and purplish, like she'd been crying. Then Mia stopped and let out a sound like a kicked dog. What? What is that? That was the thing Summer was holding, the sad, ragged bundle of fur. Except that when she kneeled, I saw it wasn't a that at all, but an animal. A live animal, or half-live animal, the helpless, staring eyes, the twitchy tail now stilled, the mouth coated in vomit and foam. Bandit. The ball's cat. Barely breathing, letting out faint wheezes, hissing noises like an old radiator. My whole body went dead with shock. I couldn't move. My tongue felt like a slug, swollen and useless. Mia's whimpers were coming faster now. She sounded like a squeaky toy getting stepped on again and again. What did you do? I managed to say. Summer was busy placing rocks. Bandit was stretched out on his side, stomach heaving obviously in pain, and Summer was putting rocks in a circle. And she may have been crying before, but now she was totally calm. Are you going to help? She said. Or are you just going to stand there and watch?
What did you do?
I was surprised to hear that I was shouting.
We have to save him, Mia whispered. Her color was all wrong. Her skin had a sick algae glow to it, and I remember thinking, this must be a dream. It must be. He's in pain.
Summer looked up and frowned. It's just a cat, she said. She actually sounded annoyed, like we were the ones being unreasonable. Mia moved like someone was tugging on all her limbs at different times, jerk, 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 like a puppet. She was inside the circle on her knees in the dirt with the cat. Shh, she was lifting her hand, trying to touch him, trying to help. Shh, it's okay, it's going to be okay. Crying so hard that she was sucking in her own snot. It's not going to be okay, Mia. Summer was still frowning. She was done with the rocks and started in with the gasoline. She must have stolen a can from her foster dad's garage. The cat's going to die, that's the whole point. A little gasoline ended up on Mia's jean shorts and Summer giggled. Oops.
What did you do?
I took two steps forward, and I was standing in the circle and I shoved her hard. She fell backward, landing in the dirt, releasing the can of gas. Glug, glug, glug. It disappeared into the dirt.
Jesus Christ!
Now she was the one shouting at me.
What do you think a sacrifice is? I mixed some rat poison into its food. The stupid thing was too dumb not to eat it.
I hit her. All of a sudden, I was burning hot and explosive, and I wound up and balled up my fist and clocked her. I'd been in fights plenty of times before, but I'd never punched anyone, and I'll never forget the sick, spongy way her skin felt and the crack of her cheekbone under my knuckles. Mia screamed, but Summer drew in a quick breath, sharp, like she'd been startled. She wasn't even mad, she just looked at me, tired, patient, like she was waiting for my anger to run out. And I knew then that she'd been hit before, plenty of times, and acid burned up from my stomach and into my mouth. Are you going to help me? She said again in a quieter voice and stood up. Then I saw she was holding a knife. A long knife with a sharp blade like the kind used for carving turkeys on Thanksgiving, separating flesh from bone.
It's just a game,
I whispered. Even my mouth tasted like ash. I could hardly speak, could hardly breathe, felt like I was choking. She shook her head. It was never a game, she said quietly.
That's what I've been trying to tell you. This is the only way. She looked sorry. In a lower voice, she added, there has to be blood. She looked down to the cat still shuddering out his life, and to Mia bent over trying to whisper him back to health, her long, thin neck exposed, stalk-like, her shoulders bare in her tank top, heaving. I saw pale skin, life thrumming through her veins. I saw Summer with a knife, Summer saying, I'm sorry. I couldn't think straight. Mia, I said, and thank God she listened to me. Mia always listened to me. Run!
When it comes to the heart, there is no right and wrong, the shadow told Summer. Only what it needs to keep beating. From Return to Lovelorn, by Summer Marks.